I do want to move on. I want to get into our coverage of the war in Iran. Like I said, day 24 of the conflict. We've now entered the fourth week. Two more weeks, guys. Just two more weeks. Two more weeks to flatten Iran, and then we're out. Then we're done. And our big development for today is about the mother of all tacos. Trump always chickens out. And honestly, this one caught me a little bit by surprise. I can't lie. I honestly thought on Saturday, I said, there's no way he's walking away from this. Because my gut, and I'll explain it in just a moment, but my gut was, he always chickens out. Every time he does this, with Russia, with China, with North Korea, with Europe, with Canada, with Mexico, he always makes these big over-the-top threats and ultimatums. And then invariably, every time, he always chickens out. And so he'll tell Russia, you've got 60 days to make a deal or else, I don't know, something's going to happen. And then we arrive at the deadline and Trump says, you know, never mind. We're making great progress. There's really no need for that. He'll say with China, if China puts tariffs, if they retaliate with tariffs against our tariffs, well, then we're going to increase it to 100% and then 200% and then... And China retaliates with tariffs, and then Trump begs Beijing to back off. So this has been the pattern over the past year and a half. You had this in the first administration, but it's really a problem in the second term. So on Saturday, Trump issues this huge ultimatum against Iran. I didn't get a chance to cover it because I didn't do a show on Saturday. But over the weekend, Trump puts out on Truth Social this huge threat and says, if Iran doesn't open up the Strait of Hormuz in 48 hours, then we are going to destroy their energy infrastructure. We're going to destroy their oil, their natural gas, all their critical infrastructure. As we have talked about up until this point, this is the nuclear option. Not the literal nuclear option, which might still be on the table, but this is a huge red line in the conflict to cross. If he did that, it would constitute a significant escalation, which Trump has been trying to avoid, actually. And we talked about this all last week. The reason that Trump and the United States don't want to make this an energy war is because, one, an energy war of any kind will constrain the global energy supply and cause inflation. Everything runs on energy. Transportation, industry, all of it. It all runs fundamentally on electricity and fossil fuels. And even the electricity runs on fossil fuels for the most part also. So if we attack Iran's energy, we constrain all the energy and prices go up. But then additionally, Iran can do the same thing to us and our energy providers. And so what we do to them, they will visit upon us and the effect is compounded. They will attack the energy in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, elsewhere, and that will further constrain the energy supply, further increase prices. So that's why this is a really big deal. Trump says if they don't open up the strait, which they're surely not going to do, if they don't open up the strait, we're going to decimate their energy. Predictably, Iran almost immediately comes out and threatens exactly that. Iran's foreign minister comes out within hours of Trump's statement and says, well, if the United States bombs our energy, we'll bomb Saudi Arabia, we'll bomb Qatar, we'll bomb the United Arab Emirates. And what's more, Iran said that energy infrastructure is civilian infrastructure. So Trump is talking about the electrical grid. He's actually talking about power plants. He's talking about the electrical grid. He's actually talking about the supply of energy in Iran. Just like in Ukraine, this is a very big factor in their war. So the foreign minister of Iran comes out and says, this is civilian infrastructure. It's also energy infrastructure. So if we get hit in that way, which technically is a war crime, then we will not only retaliate against the Gulf energy infrastructure, Saudi Aramco, Qatari LNG, and other energy infrastructure. But Iran says also, we will attack other civilian infrastructure like desalination. Now, if you know anything about the Arabian Peninsula, it's a desert. They don't have drinking water. They don't have fresh water supply there. They don't have lakes and rivers like we do. And so the way that they provide water for their huge population on these coastal cities is they desalinate the water. They take water from the Gulf and they remove the salt, the salinity, and that makes it available to drink. And these desalination plants in Qatar, in the United Arab Emirates, they supply the drinking water for the entire population. And if those desalination plants go offline, they only have a supply of drinking water for about a month. That's a big problem for the millions upon millions of people that live in these cities that rely on that for water. Otherwise, they die. Very quickly, you have a, forget about energy prices, forget about inflation. Now you've got a real problem on your hands with the tens of millions of people that live in all these major cities. So this is all predictable. And we talked about this last week. It cannot become an energy war because Iran actually, in this narrow context, maintains escalation dominance. And that means that they hold the ultimate checkmate. They have the ace up their sleeve. They have the better hand in this. They can always take it further. Whatever we do to them, they maintain the ability to launch drones and ballistic missiles because of the mobility, the abundance, the how cheap and economical these weapon systems are. And so we can literally drop nukes on them. We can drop the biggest conventional ordnance on them. We can hit them as hard as possible with our whole arsenal. We could invade for that matter. We could even invade. And they would still maintain the ability to launch missiles from the shoulder or from the back of a pickup truck going 100 miles an hour on the coast. They could still launch drones that can and will hit the desalination plant, Saudi Aramco, Qatari's LNG facilities, and inflict severe detrimental problems on the Gulf countries and then the global economy. So this is why we didn't want to take it there, because whatever we do to Iran, they could always do something worse to us, something that we actually cannot tolerate. And so this is why I say Trump makes this threat on Saturday, and he's really putting his credibility on the line, because it wasn't exactly ambiguous. There wasn't a lot of wiggle room here. Trump said in all capital letters, you have 48 hours. Open up the strait or else. If you don't open the strait in 48 hours, we're attacking Bushehr. We're attacking your electrical grid. We're attacking your power plants. And that's it. And that's your last chance for peace. These are his words. Now, the reason that this is a bit conflicting is because you say, on the one hand, Trump always chickens out. So if this is like all the other threats that Trump has given over the past 2 years or year and a half, well, he'll probably back down. Because as I said, there's a quick survey of examples. There was the trade war with China almost exactly a year ago today where Trump chickened out. There was his ultimatum, or actually series of threats against Russia over the entire course of last year, where Trump always backed down and chickened out. And so you see this threat over the weekend and say, surely this is not serious. Because if Trump follows through, and almost certainly he's going to have to, Iran maintains this capability. They're not going to open up the strait. They know how that will play out. They know that they're able to hit the Gulf, and Trump knows that, and they know Trump knows that, and so on and so forth. I said, so surely Monday will come. The Strait of Hormuz will remain closed. Trump will be forced to make good on the threat. But he knows what will happen, which is unacceptable. It's unacceptable for all the Gulf countries. It's unacceptable for Washington. So if history is our guide, then Trump will have to, in that case, back down. Monday will come. They will not open up the strait. And Trump is going to have to say, forget it. Never mind. At the same time, as we've talked about in this conflict so far, We are in a stalemate. And the stalemate consists in the fact, as we've just discussed, that Iran maintains escalation dominance. There's nothing we can do to Iran to either A, topple their regime and destroy the personnel that are carrying out and prosecuting the war, or two, suppress their ability to inflict damage on infrastructure in the Gulf and against the United States and Israel, and close the Strait of Hormuz. So if there's nothing that we can do to escalate and win, then the only available option is either we got to stick it out and fight a war of attrition. We have to fight literally until Iran runs out of ammunition or personnel, or until their society collapses after a prolonged siege, which is devastating for us. Or, and this is the most likely outcome, we have to retreat. We will have to retreat without achieving all of our objectives. We'll have to leave the Iranian regime intact. They effectively exercised a veto over our war using the Strait of Hormuz, which means that now we've ceded control of the Strait and therefore the global energy market to Iran. And even though we've inflicted a lot of damage on Iran's military, they will be able to say, for those reasons, it's a strategic victory for them. They will say the U.S. and Israel threw everything at us and we survived. And that's our mandate to govern. That is why the Islamic regime isn't going anywhere. And what's more, the United States better not try that again. And there's a word for this. It's called deterrence. Iran has reestablished deterrence over the U.S. and Israel. Whereas in the past, the U.S. and Israel provoked Iran repeatedly and confronted Iran and seemed fearless in provoking and confronting Iran because they made assumptions that they could defeat Iran. Now, Iran is able to say, well, you tried it and you failed. You lost. You didn't get what you wanted. We denied you. And so now in the future, you will be less likely to confront us again, because you saw what we're made of and you saw what you're up against. You saw that in the end, there's nothing you can do. We're too big, too many people, our bench is too deep, we have too many drones and missiles. So in the future, you're not going to try it. We have effectively deterred you from intervening again. Now, this is a very critical concept. The reason that Trump wants to escalate to de-escalate, the reason that Trump wants to find a way to exert leverage against Iran through escalation, without boots on the ground, without nukes, to break the stalemate, is because he knows, and the military planners know, and Israel knows, that if we just walk away without any grand finale, without a climax, without actually achieving anything tangible or persuasive that we can tell people that we won, then that is what it looks like. It looks like we went whole hog, we didn't get what we wanted, we shrugged, and we walked away. And the whole world has taken notice, Iran included, and their people, that Iran won the war. So what Trump is trying to do to break the stalemate is he is going to have to, in a way, bluff his way out of this. In order to avert a situation where he loses face and gives Iran that strategic victory, he's going to have to find a way to land a blow against Iran in a way that doesn't escalate out of control, where we're invading or bringing boots on the ground or there's serious casualties or there's some humiliating American tactical defeat. He's going to need to inflict some kind of blow to increase leverage, to extract some concession. And that is your escalate to de-escalate. Increasing the firepower in a creative way to achieve a tactical victory so that we can retreat with honor, withdraw with some dignity. And that way, we break the stalemate, we exit the conflict without losing face, without losing deterrence, without handing Iran that strategic victory. So what is very important about all of this is credibility. If Trump is telling Iran, hey, we don't care will destroy your energy. And even if you retaliate, hey, see if we care. We can take it. We're strong. We're fortified. Trump has to effectively convince Iran that he is suicidal. He has to convince Iran that he is willing to do things to them that might be detrimental for us, but we don't care. It's a confidence game. It's a game of chicken. He's got to bluff his way out of this. He needs to convince them he's serious that he might invade, that he might send a ground force in, that he's willing to drag this on for 100 days. I think that's what a lot of these leaks and planted stories and even logistical moves are about. When they say we're preparing for a 100-day conflict or going into September or the fall, what they are signaling to Iran is don't think you're going to stick it out. Don't think you're going to wait us out and you're going to bleed us with oil. They're almost communicating an irrationality. It's a madman strategy. They're telling Iran, if you think that you've got us by the balls, if you think that you're going to use the oil market to hurt us economically and you're going to force our hand and you're going to somehow get out of this scot-free, you're mistaken because we're settling in for the long haul. And I think that's why they make those moves. Because every time you see a statement like that, every time you see a story like that that says we're moving intelligence and logistics personnel down to Florida until September, when they say we need $200 billion to fight a six-month war, when they say these things, we're going to hear that and groan and say, oh, another forever war. When Trump says, we're considering boots on the ground, I don't care about the poll numbers, I don't care if it's popular, we groan, but Iran says, maybe they're serious. And then the planners in Iran have to wonder, are we overplaying our hand? Because if there's a chance that the U.S. and Israel are crazy enough to stick it out, if they think, again, and they might not be certain, but that's all they need is a seed of doubt. If they have any doubt that the Strait of Hormuz strategy is working or not, and they think maybe the U.S. can tolerate the hit to energy, the hit to the economy, that they have an appetite for a protracted attritional conflict at a low level, well, they're going to start to ponder their mortality. And they're going to wonder, how much of this can we take? Sure, we can close the strait and it will cause inflation and there will be some difficult correction in the U.S. economy, but we're literally going to get assassinated. In a long enough timeline, if the war does go on until the summer or the fall, the leadership might actually get killed. And with all these airstrikes at this pace, thousands of airstrikes every day, maybe we won't have a military by the end of this, and maybe Iranian society will collapse. But in order for Trump to achieve that effect, he needs them to be confident in his threats. He needs credibility to reestablish deterrence in the other direction. And so this is why on Saturday, when Trump made the threat, I said, although he always chickens out, he's gonna have to follow through. Because although Iran's retaliation against our energy would be devastating if Trump followed through, if he chickens out, it might be worse. Because chickening out causes us to lose credibility, lose face, and then we lose our ability, we lose our credibility to bluff and convince Iran that they don't have us by the balls. And yet, Trump chickened out. Even though this is like the all-important ultimatum, you can't do this. It's so reckless in a conflict of this nature, in the situation that we're in. Trump chickened out. And so this morning, it did surprise me, actually. Trump came out this morning and said, actually, we're going to postpone the deadline. We're going to give Iran 5 days. If Iran doesn't open the Strait of Hormuz within the new timeline, which is by the end of this week, then we will carry out the strikes. He said, but we're postponing it because we're actually making progress on a deal. Trump says that his administration has spoken to the Iranian regime and they have made progress on a framework for a deal, one where the U.S. and Iran might actually work together. And Trump also implied that the deal is almost finalized. He said that every point of agreement, or rather every point of contention, has been resolved. And they agree on all the fundamentals. And Iran has agreed to share the strait and give up nuclear enrichment and give up their highly enriched material and all these things. And this is just, in the first place, who even believes this? At 7:30 a.m., Trump comes out in the press pool and on Truth Social and first of all says, never mind, forget the 48-hour deadline. We're postponing it by 5 days. And you think, this is just not serious. There's nothing serious about any of this. Trump is not serious. This is not a serious government. This is a joke. They're lying. I don't believe them. They're flying by the seat of their pants. Everything they do is ad hoc. Everything they do is last minute. There was no plan going into this. There was no plan B. And so they're literally making it up as they go along. And this is just ridiculous. And so Trump says, we're calling off the deadline. Okay, so every day it's something different. You have no credibility. Nobody believes even what you're saying. It's all a lie. But then he goes into the press pool and says, we've talked to Iran. We agree on everything. They've agreed on every point. And you say, that's a lie. That, who believes that? I don't even believe they're talking to the Iranian government. Who would they be talking to? I don't even think that's the case. You're not talking to Iran. And then he says, well, we're reaching a deal. We have a very strong deal and we have all this agreement. No, you don't. Trump said that Iran has agreed to share the Strait of Hormuz with America. Why would they do that? If anything, it's the opposite. Iran has said, even when the conflict ends, there will be a new dynamic in the Strait of Hormuz, meaning they want control over the Strait the way that Egypt has control over the Suez. And if you don't know what that means, it means they want sovereignty over it. They want the Strait of Hormuz to be effectively Iranian territory. And that means they want to charge a toll. So all the shipping that goes through, just like the shipping that goes through Panama, and just like the shipping that goes through the Suez, they want to extract a fee, a toll, on all the shipping that goes through. So that's what they're saying, and that makes sense. They've earned it. They've fought for it, and they've won that. They have that right now. It was reported today that a few tankers paid a $2 million toll to cross the strait this morning. So they have that. They fought for it, they have it, and we have no ability to suppress that. So why then would they agree to share this newly won capability with the United States, their mortal enemy? It doesn't make any sense. And their demands, if you read them last week, are opposites. Iran demands that the U.S. leave all its military bases in the Middle East and pay reparations and give them control of the strait and never attack Iran again. Those are Iran's demands. And the U.S. demands are that Iran cannot have any ballistic missiles and they cannot have nuclear enrichment and they have to give over their highly enriched uranium. And these two positions are completely the opposite. And yet Trump in the press pool says, It's basically a done deal. So what is really going on? That's the question. And we're going to get to the bottom of it. This is a story from the Wall Street Journal. We'll work through some of these announcements, and then we'll talk about a few different aspects of this. It says, quote, on Saturday night, President Trump, who spent the weekend at his Mar-a-Lago club, gave Iran an ultimatum to reopen the Strait of Hormuz within 48 hours, or the U.S. military would obliterate the country's power plants. 2 days later, as word of the discussions in Riyadh made its way to the White House, Trump reversed course, embracing diplomacy with Tehran and putting his threatened strikes on hold. Trump's shift Monday morning followed a series of closed-door discussions through Middle Eastern intermediaries that U.S. officials said gave them hope that an agreement to settle the conflict was possible. It also reflected a growing desire by Trump and some of his advisors to bring the war to a close. Trump's announcement that he would postpone for 5 days strikes on Iranian power plants triggered a stock market rally, giving the president a small reprieve after weeks of pain on Wall Street. But Arab mediators privately expressed skepticism that the U.S. and Iran could quickly reach an agreement, noting that the two sides remained far apart. Trump's assertion that the talks were productive was met with pushback from Iranian officials who denied that the discussions were taking place. So, like I said, we don't even know what's going on. Trump is lying, and we really have no clue how much of this is the fog of war, how much of this is just BS from Trump. It goes on, it says, as a condition of any deal to end the war, Iran is demanding that the U.S. and Israel pledge not to launch future attacks. Tehran is pushing for compensation for damages sustained during the war. The U.S. still wants what it sought from Iran before the war started, which is the dismantling of Tehran's nuclear complex, a suspension of its ballistic missile program, and a stop to its support for proxy militias. Mohammed Bagher Ghalibaf, Iran's parliamentary speaker and one of the country's top remaining officials, suggested Monday that Tehran wasn't yet ready for negotiations with Washington. He wrote in English a few hours after Trump's comments, quote, "Iranian people demand complete and remorseful punishment of the aggressors." He said that such optimism about negotiations is, quote, "used to manipulate the financial and oil markets and escape the quagmire in which the U.S. and Israel are trapped." So let's unpack this a little bit. Here's the timeline. So Thursday, there are these reports that Turkey, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar are lobbying the United States to make peace with Iran. These mediators are stepping in and they're trying to find a resolution. Europe is advocating for this behind the scenes as well. And so there is talk of talking. There are a lot of rumors that back channels and closed door indirect meetings through intermediaries are happening. We have no idea if that's true. But there's all these rumors that some Iranian personnel are indirectly talking to some American personnel about how to bring the war to a close. And this is being brokered, like I said, by other regional powers. Now, I wouldn't read too much into this, because as it stands right now, these Arab intermediaries, they seem to have no influence at all. It was these Arab intermediaries that tried to get the U.S. and Iran together for this second round of negotiations a month ago. It was Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Emirates, Oman, Turkey, Pakistan, all these Egypt, all these countries, they all tried in February to get the U.S. and Iran back together in a room, which they then did in Oman, in Switzerland, to try to hash it out, and it didn't work. And they are lobbying the United States to try to de-escalate the conflict even now. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Emirates, they want us to finish Iran off, but they want the war over because they cannot sustain these attacks on their infrastructure. It's destroying their real estate, tourism, banking industries, not to mention energy, not to mention the trade that's been disrupted with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And that's not working either. So there's much talk, none of it confirmed, none of it verified, and all of it being denied. Iran denies they're talking to the United States in any capacity. And yet there are these persistent rumors that Arab countries are trying to broker a deal. This is on Thursday. Saturday, Trump makes this ultimatum and says that Iran has to open up the strait or else. Now, as I said at the top of the show, one of the theories here, one of the working theories, is that everything that Trump does, all of these bellicose threats, all of the biggest operations, they always happen during the weekend. And I'm talking about just in the past several weeks since this war started. If you recall, the war started on Friday at midnight, which is in the middle of the daytime in Iran. Normally, you don't launch your all-out ambush sneak attack during the day because you want to do it under the cover of darkness. So why did they do it at midnight on Friday? Well, they gave some excuses. They said there was confidence that the Ayatollah would be in his residence at that time. They had to act on the intelligence. And there's some other tactical reasons, they said. Could possibly the reason be that the markets had closed? The markets open on Monday morning. They close on Friday afternoon. So did Trump wait until the markets closed to launch an attack on Iran? Why would he do that? Well, the reason is any war in the Persian Gulf is going to cause significant pain in the stock market because oil, natural gas, fertilizer, and other essential commodities, helium, as well as aluminum, many things, especially things that are needed for data centers, technology, that all moves through the Persian Gulf and out the Strait of Hormuz. Everybody knows you bomb Iran, Strait of Hormuz is closed, and you're going to get an economic catastrophe. So in other words, Trump waits for the markets to close to basically cuck all the traders and investors. They're panicking. They see the writing on the wall, which is that there's going to be a global energy crisis, followed by a food shortage, followed by the entire AI bubble is going to burst in that order. You bomb Iran, they close the Strait of Hormuz. Strait of Hormuz is closed. You constrain the supply of LNG, which causes huge price spikes in Europe. It constrains the supply of oil, which causes an energy shortage in Asia, and the price of oil skyrockets and it causes inflation. After that, because fertilizer flows through the Gulf, most farmers have not secured fertilizer yet. You're going to have a food shortage. That's going to cause all inflation to rise. Without helium, without other components, the cost of electricity coupled with the cost of components for data centers is going to make all of these AI companies not profitable because they run on energy and commodities that go through the strait. And that is the source of all the GDP growth for the past year. So you have these cascading effects that all the traders and investors know about, but they can't do anything about it until Monday. So Trump launches the attack Friday night, and they say the war will last 4 days. Well, why do they say 4 days? Because by the third day, from you also have the timing that it was the Jewish holiday of Purim, which was on Monday, which is interesting. And that's when the Jews commemorate the slaughter of 80,000 Iranians after they win a war against them. But why do they say 4 days? They want to launch the war on Friday after markets close, fight really hard through Saturday, through Sunday, hoping that by Monday morning, it's almost over. And by Monday morning, everybody is relieved. Everybody is no longer panicking. They see that Trump has got everything under control. They're trusting the plan. Plan trusters are in control. And the economy resumes as normal. Maybe that was the play. And it was also last week that Trump launched the attack on Karg Island. Remember when when Trump bombed Karg Island, which is the central hub of Iran's energy that goes through the Persian Gulf? That was on a Friday as well. Bombed all the military assets, not the energy, but the military assets, the runway strip and the dock and all the military assets, also on a Friday. And then this weekend launches this ultimatum on Saturday night. 48 hours expires on Monday night. And the question is, did Trump do all of this so that by Monday morning, if Iran did not open up the strait, then Trump could call it all off and he could say, well, we're not going to hit Iran anymore. So all of Wall Street can relax. He says it after the markets close, so they'll all panic in the after hours trading. And then before markets open on Monday morning, he can change his mind. And it looks like that's exactly what happened. Just judging by the timeline alone, his announcement on Saturday caused everything to tank. It caused oil to skyrocket, gold collapsed, Bitcoin collapsed. The S&P 500 collapsed. Everything collapsed on Saturday because, again, all the investors and traders priced in that we're going to be rebuilding the energy economy for the next 5 years. If Trump bombs these power plants and Iran bombs, they unleash on LNG oil and desalination, it's over. And they knew that. But then Trump saves the day on Monday morning and says, you know what, never mind. And then the markets flipped. And all of a sudden, when the markets open a half hour later, everything rallies. And so whereas the market lost $2 trillion on Saturday, it made up about half of that minutes after Trump's announcement on Monday morning. And you have to wonder, first of all, clearly, there is a calculated deception going on. This is part of U.S. tactics and strategy. You cannot trust the government in a time of war because what the government says and does is also read and heard and seen by the enemy. So it's a signal. It's not just information for the masses. It's a signal to our opponents. So from on its face, from first principles, you can't trust what the government says. But we also now know the government is just engaging in strategic lying. They're just lying about everything. All the actors in the whole government are lying about everything all the time. They're lying about that school that was hit. They're lying about who started the war, the imminent threat. They're lying about everything. And this whole 48-hour ultimatum was a ruse. It was another deception. That's one. So number one is you can't trust Trump on anything. Everything he says is a lie. Number two, aside from that, and maybe more to the point, Trump is conducting a foreign policy with regard to the markets. And you sort of have to do that on some level. We are in a war of attrition. It's now an economic war. And that means that it concerns the allocation of resources. It's not just about killing their guys and blowing up their stuff. It's now about supply chains, logistics, securing essential commodities, keeping our economy going, controlling prices in the world. If that's the case, then you do have to take into account how the markets are going to react. And Trump, as commander in chief, fighting this economic attritional war, he does have to take care of the markets. He does have to reassure the people that are buying and selling the commodities, that are speculating on the commodities. Number three, and this is maybe the most problematic aspect of it, and this is a question I think everybody's been asking from the beginning. All of that is fine and well. I actually don't think there's anything inherently wrong with this. Because if you are in a war, you can't telegraph all your moves, actually. You do need secrecy, and sometimes you do need to float out a signal that deceives the enemy. I'm not necessarily against that. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. And I also don't think there's anything inherently wrong with reassuring the markets. Is that a good strategy? I don't think so. But is that technically part of the commander-in-chief's job if you're fighting an attritional war? I don't think that's outside of bounds for his jurisdiction, for his job. But this is the rub, and this is what everybody's secretly wondering. So who knew? Who knew that Trump was going to call it off, and when did they know that? This is the problem, because Trump does this all the time, where he puts out something on Truth Social or something on TV or in a press pool, and as you know, it does affect the markets, and trillions of dollars are made and lost on a whim, based on what he says, based on what he tweets. He controls the movement of all that wealth and all of that stuff. If you knew just 10 minutes before that post was going out, you could have made a lot of money. You could have placed a lot of big bets. And you could have made millions, billions, depending on what kind of capital you're working with. And so you got to wonder, if you knew that that announcement was coming on Saturday, and if you knew that that announcement was coming on Monday, based on conversations with the president, or you knew some other way, you could have made a fortune shorting everything on Saturday and then making money on Monday. You could have made a small fortune. And as people have reported, many people have. Many people did put in some very conspicuous positions on Saturday and on Monday and did make a lot of money. And you wonder how much prior knowledge they had. Is the government making moves like this? Are government personnel making moves like this? Because if so, then this is the most corrupt administration in history. And I don't think that's, again, that other stuff, fine and well. You could say that is within your purview as the president of the United States. You want to confuse the enemy. You want to reassure the markets. But if every post that goes out concerning tariffs, concerning trade, war with Russia, war with Iran, if all of that is known in advance by advisors and leaked to other people, well, there could be a lot of cronies that are being enriched by that Truth Social account. And that's not okay. That's like Banana Republic, Soviet levels of corruption. And that's the part I don't like. But so that's one angle on what is happening. Now, and I think to a large extent, that explains what is happening. I think that's just true, that every weekend since the war started, this is how the U.S. and Trump in particular are prosecuting the war. It's a confidence game. It's a confidence game between the U.S. and Iran. It's a confidence game in the markets, in the U.S. market. And this is why Trump does the most provocative, destabilizing things during the weekend, and I think tends to exercise more restraint during the week, because he knows that a vital aspect of this attritional war is that reassurance and making sure that the economy doesn't completely melt down in the early stages of the war. And like I said, I think that's just undeniable at this point. But let's talk about the larger point. So as we've said, we're in this stalemate. And where we left off last week is that Trump is looking for a creative way to break the stalemate. So 2 weeks ago, he hit Karg Island. As we discussed, that is an island in the Persian Gulf, about 300 miles northwest of the Strait of Hormuz. This is where 90% of all of Iran's oil and energy is exported. That's where it's picked up on tankers, and then it moves to its final destination. It was 2 weeks ago that Trump launched a huge air campaign against the island, not attacking its energy infrastructure, but against its military assets. And then the following day, Trump authorized an Israeli strike on Iran's gas fields, the Southern Pars gas fields, which has so much gas alone in that field it could power the world for years. It's a huge energy reserve. And as we talked about, what those two developments showed is that potentially the United States is inching towards an energy war, which would mark a significant escalation. This is a stalemate. It has become an attritional economic war, and it is a question of the economics of missiles and interceptors, the air and sea campaign of the United States, and the drone and missile capability of Iran. The military pain we can inflict on Iranian personnel and hardware, and the economic pain they can inflict on the Gulf and the world economy with their strikes on the Strait and on the GCC nations. So this is the stalemate, and Trump is looking for a way out of it. We don't seem to be able to stop Iran from closing the strait. We don't seem to be able to topple their government or suppress their other fire against Israel, U.S. assets in the Gulf, although we are hitting them very hard. As long as the war goes on, we are paying the price economically because the price of energy, the price of food is going up, and is threatening our very fragile economy, which is emerging from stagflation. Now, the only realm in which Trump seems to be able to escalate is this third avenue into the realm of energy. We're using all of our air power, all of our sea power, and we can't achieve our objectives. We don't want to walk away, but we also don't want to use ground force. We don't want to invade. We don't want to use a nuclear weapon, which is how we control the escalation ladder. So what can we do that's short of nuking them, short of an invasion, but also is a way to increase leverage against Iran so that we don't have to retreat and surrender? Trump is looking for options in that area. He's looking for options that fit that criterion. And it seems that the only leverage we can have over them, because we're bombing their personnel, we're bombing their military hardware, we're bombing their bases, regime targets, we're bombing everything, their nuclear infrastructure even this weekend. What can we increase without increasing too much? And it seems that the only category of targets that fits that criteria is energy. But as we talked about, the reason we don't want to go that far is because if we escalate the war against Iran's energy, they retaliate in exactly the same way. And this is a fine line. This is a tripwire that neither side wants to activate. If we bomb Iran's energy, they hit the Gulf, and the effects of the attrition are far worse. And Iran doesn't want to hit our energy because then they lose all their leverage. We got nothing left to lose if they hit everything in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the other Gulf nations. So it seems that the only way that we can escalate is in that category. And yet, that's the one category that we also can't touch. And so Trump is trying to find a middle ground. How can we bluff and convince Iran that we're going for their energy without actually doing it? Because if we do it, it's 10 times worse for us. But we need them to think that we're willing to do it anyway. So maybe that's why last weekend, again, during the weekend, Trump bombs Karg Island, their number one energy hub, but not their energy, just the military assets. It's just a little too close to comfort, and it's a warning shot. Trump is telling Iran, don't test us, because next time we'll hit the energy. Well, Iran didn't get the message. So 3 days later, Trump authorizes Israel to bomb Iran's southern Pars gas fields. And then we really hit their energy. And Trump said, how do you like that? Okay, so we bombed Karg Island. You didn't flinch. Now we hit the southern Pars gas fields. What now? Well, predictably, Iran carried out their attacks, which I'm sure were planned in advance, against Qatar's LNG plant, which supplies 20% of the world's liquefied natural gas. And they hit Saudi Aramco. And they hit a number of other targets in the Gulf as well. And this was catastrophic. And immediately the market reacted first. And then Trump came out and said, we had nothing to do with this Israeli strike. And as long as you don't keep going against us, we will restrain Israel from attacking your energy. So you see that Trump is testing the boundaries here. It's a game of chicken. It's a push and pull. Hit Karg Island, no reaction. Hit the gas fields, whoops, too far. Iran retaliated. And we realized quickly, and the Gulf convinced us of this, that that was a bridge too far. It was detrimental. And so Qatar and the Saudis and the Emiratis came to Washington and said, we can't take hits like this on our energy. If they hit the desalination plant, we're all going to be dehydrated to death. We can't do it. So now this weekend, Trump tries something. Trump, once again, he's back at it. That was last weekend. This weekend, Trump comes out and says, he got 48 hours, but this time we're going to do. Then he says, never mind. Now let's talk about the next week. So you might say, and again, there's been rumors of this. Trump says, we called off the strikes on Iran's energy because we're working on a deal with Iran through these intermediaries. And I think that's basically a fiction. I don't think that's happening. To the extent that's happening, it's being overhyped and overblown. Turkey, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, they have no influence over us, at least as it pertains to this conflict. They seem to be completely impotent. So their intercession is no help. Trump says, we're talking to Iran. Iran denies it. They say, we haven't even talked to the United States at all. Trump says that we already have an agreement, practically speaking, and there's a, no pun intended, there's a gulf between the two positions. Iran wants us to leave the Middle East, pay them reparations, give them the Strait of Hormuz, And the United States wants Iran to denuclearize, give up their nuclear complex enrichment, their material. We want them to not have ballistic missiles for 5 years. Neither side is even close to the other side. Arguably, we're further apart than when we started. So that's overhyped, overblown. Trump says he's postponing that 5 days because there's an agreement. Well, Iran says they're not even talking. So what's the real reason that Trump postponed for 5 days? Well, if you understand the timeline, you understand perfectly well what's coming next. He's waiting for next weekend for his next push. Last week was Karg Island and the Southern Pars gas fields. That didn't work. This past weekend was this ultimatum. Iran didn't listen. Next weekend is going to be another big push. So Trump says we're postponing it 5 days pending these negotiations, which Iran denies are even happening. And Arab intermediaries are saying, don't believe the hype. Don't get too optimistic. There's no agreement on any of these points between the two countries. Well, simultaneously, while all of this is happening, the United States has deployed 4,000 to 5,000 U.S. Marines on amphibious assault vehicles to the Persian Gulf from the Pacific. These are amphibious assault vessels. What does that mean? It means they're supposed to launch an invasion of the land from the sea. It's 5,000 Marines. They got Osprey aircraft on board. They've got a ground contingent. They've got a sea contingent. They've got all kinds of self-contained systems on these ships. 5,000 Marines headed for the Persian Gulf. And when do they arrive in the Middle East? They will enter CENTCOM's area of responsibility by Friday. The Marines get to the Persian Gulf on Friday. And the other story from today is that not only this force, by the way, keeps being reinforced. It started with 2,200 Marines, and then it increased to 4,000 to 5,000 Marines. And they were sailing for one destination, then the timeline was accelerated and the destination changed. And now today, there are rumors from the Pentagon that the 82nd Airborne Division will join them in the Middle East to reinforce the Marines. So these are ground forces that will parachute in from the air, and they are intended to reinforce the Marines when they get to the Gulf. In what capacity, you might say? Well, this is a story from the New York Times. It says, quote, senior military officials are weighing a possible deployment of a combat brigade from the Army's 82nd Airborne Division and some elements of the division's headquarters staff to support U.S. operations in Iran. The combat forces would come from the 82nd Airborne's Immediate Response Force. That's a brigade of about 3,000 soldiers capable of deploying anywhere in the world within 18 hours. These forces could be used to seize Karg Island, Iran's main oil export hub. Another possibility being considered is an attack by about 2,500 troops from the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit, which is already on its way to the region. The airfield on Karg Island was damaged by the recent U.S. bombing raids, so former U.S. commander said it was more likely to bring in Marines whose combat engineers could quickly repair airfields and other airport infrastructure. Once the airfield is repaired, the Air Force can begin flying in supplies as well as troops, if necessary, by C-130s. In that scenario, it's possible that troops from the 82nd Airborne would augment the Marines. The Marines lack the sustainment and staying power of the forces from the 82nd Airborne, which might be used to relieve the Marine forces after the initial attack on the island. So a battle plan is taking shape, where the Marines will land on the island, which has already been demilitarized, right? 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, Trump bombed the airfield. Trump bombed the naval dock. Trump bombed all the military assets, leaving the civilian infrastructure intact. So the amphibious assault unit will land on the island. They'll repair the military assets. That will then be the staging ground for the 82nd Airborne to begin flying in. Then you've got a runway, literally, to land on, and you can start bringing in ground forces, supplies. You can start bringing in the heavy machinery, the heavy equipment. All you need is that small and nimble attack force to take over a demilitarized island. They put it back together. Then they get relieved by the real ground force. Then that starts getting flown in, and then that becomes the base of operations. And what might be the plan there? Well, it's pretty obvious. At least this is what their thinking is, and this is what they're telegraphing. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, these are just a mouthpiece of the Pentagon and the intelligence community. But what they're telegraphing to the public is that this is going to be a limited tactical ground force operation. If we can't destroy their energy infrastructure, we're going to commandeer it. We're going to take control of it. So if we destroy it, it would take years to rebuild it. We could drop bombs on Karg Island and we could drop bombs on their energy. Here's the problem. They bomb our energy also. And so in the short term, again, you have this supply shock. You have this big energy crunch. But it's also a long-term problem because all that infrastructure takes years to rebuild. So bombing is out of the question. You bomb that stuff, it takes it offline for a decade. You're behind the curve already. Then they retaliate, and the other stuff takes a decade to rebuild. So we definitely don't want that. Maybe the middle path, again, it's all about calibrating the strategy here. How can we escalate it in a way that increases leverage on Iran to extract concessions so that we can withdraw with honor? Well, there's a very narrow path to do that. There's not much we could do with air and naval power that we're not doing already. A ground invasion is out of the question because it's too ambitious and unpopular and maybe wouldn't even work. Energy is where we can hit them where it hurts, but it's also something that we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. If we attack their energy, they retaliate. It exacerbates the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the problems associated with that. So what if, instead of invading Iran's mainland, we invade an Iranian island? Then we don't need to send in a 500,000 troops. We could send in a few thousand. Instead of calling it a nation-building ground war where they're going to be facing IEDs and IRGC and tons of stuff on the ground that will cause significant casualties. It'll be like a modern Vietnam. We could take an unfortified tiny island that's already been bombed to smithereens. At least the military resistance would be. And instead of destroying the energy infrastructure, which would take years to rebuild and would be taken offline for any regime, we can simply take control of it and form our own effective embargo. And so Iran has closed the Strait of Hormuz. At the same time, they're able to put their energy through the strait and collect tolls. If we took control of their main energy export hub, then we would deny them the oil revenue. And we'd be able to strangle their energy sector without destroying it. And that might be the tactical victory that we need, where you can say, we achieved our victory condition. One, we had a successful military operation. We showed off our military prowess. No one else could have achieved this. Unambiguously, we won this battle. One, so you can't call it a defeat where, you know, we just had all our refueling aircraft blown up and people got traumatic brain injuries at the bases. We can say, look, we did this. We killed the Ayatollah, we blew up their navy, and we took the island. So you have your honor intact. You save face. Two, it's a pain point. It's leverage. You can now increase the leverage against Iran and extract concessions. We will have to give something, but so will they. We will have to give up some concessions. Maybe we share the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe we don't get everything that we want. But with Karg Island, we also now have some cards. We can also play this game as well. And again, that goes back to, it's not only the optics of winning a tactical victory, we're also able to escalate in order to achieve an acceptable peace agreement where we don't lose deterrence and give Iran an unambiguous strategic victory. That's the second aspect of it. And then thirdly, again, we're able to do this without overcommitting. We're able to do this without a ground invasion. We don't need to topple the government. We don't need to suppress every Iranian drone and missile. We just need to hit this vulnerable point. We just need to hit that pain point. And then we're able to escalate, to de-escalate. We're able to extricate ourselves from the conflict. And it looks like maybe that's the plan. And all this other stuff is just a big show. Bombing Karg Island was to prepare the way for this. Rather than inching towards an energy war, they were preparing the way for this amphibious assault. And maybe this ultimatum was a way to get everybody to take their eyes off the ball. And to the extent that there are negotiations going on, maybe that's another mirage, just like it was in February. Because it does echo the military buildup in the Middle East prior to the start of the war. It was in January when Trump began reinforcing the military in the Middle East. That is when he began sending the aircraft carriers, the Air Force, the ground personnel. That is when he started moving personnel away from the bases. And while the military was building up and preparing for this epic fury operation, there was this ruse of negotiations, and there were ultimatums, and there were threats, and all these things were happening in the foreground, while in the background, there was a military buildup. Now that the war has started, again, in the foreground, you have the theater of ultimatums and symbolic strikes, and there's this debate, did the United States authorize a strike on the gas field, or did they not? Well, quietly in the background, a tiny expeditionary force is moving into place. This rapid deployment airborne unit is also getting ready. And maybe the ground is being prepared for one of these limited tactical ground operations. And that's how you might seize victory from the jaws of defeat. What's more, there's been a lot of talk about expectations that a deal will be reached by April 9th, is what they say. There's a report that says the administration wants the war to wind down by that second week of April. If you look on Polymarket, there's been a lot of positions opened up in just the last 24 hours that say that a deal is going to be reached between March 31st and I think April 7th. A lot of positions. It just went from 5% to 50%. And so you wonder, is that the timeline? The next week, end of March, you're going to get this amphibious assault. Maybe that takes another week. And then that is how we bring Iran to the negotiating table. We're able to achieve the ceasefire that doesn't drag on into the summer. They meet that timeline of about 4 weeks, which is what they initially said. And then we're able to extricate ourselves. Now, here's the thing about all of that. One, we have to see what happens. If they launch this operation on Karg Island or in the Strait of Hormuz, there's a lot of ways that could go wrong because these are not very big targets and Iran has a massive coastline. It's, I think, 600 miles long, Iran's coastline with the Persian Gulf, and you know they've got positions all along the coastline where they've got drones, shoulder-mounted missiles, other missile launch platforms. So you send Marines onto Karg Island, and maybe the reason they're not worried about this is because Iran won't risk launching imprecise projectiles at their moneymaker. Is Karg Island too fragile for Iran to hit with their own projectiles? Maybe that's the thinking, but you have to expect that the Iranians have prepared for this. Did they not anticipate that the Marines might try to invade the island? Is it rigged with IEDs? Do they have a protocol in place to hit it with drones or more precise munitions? There's a lot of risks associated with this, and we don't actually know the capabilities on either side. We don't know what capabilities the United States has up its sleeve. We don't know what capabilities Iran has up its sleeve. A lot of it's confidential, and a lot of it you don't know until it happens. So we'll determine by the success of the operation if this is the right approach for the conflict. But I would say that even outside of that, if the United States seizes Karg Island, you have to anticipate that Iran is not going to readily make peace straight away. Because the United States and Israel have not fundamentally abandoned their ultimate goal, which is regime change. We talked about it this time. We talked about it last year. This is mowing the grass. We are in a rhythm here. This is not a one and done like Midnight Hammer and Rising Lion. Those were the joint Israel-U.S. operations in June of last year. We have now worked ourselves into a rhythm where we hit Iran really hard, and then Iran gets emboldened. They become more defiant, and they go back to work building missiles, drones, and maybe even enriching more uranium. And then 6 to 9 months passes. The Israelis start to freak out about how Iran has rebuilt their missiles and Iran is on a war footing and we need a preemptive strike. We do it all over again. And the question is, have Israel and the United States abandoned their designs on Iran? I think the answer is no. They still seek regime change, but they have realized they won't achieve it this time. They thought maybe they would get it. That was clear from the announcement of the war that they were seeking a regime change. They wanted it. But just like Russia and Ukraine, they underestimated Iran's ability to hang on. And so they thought Iran would collapse after the opening round of strikes, after their leader was killed, the personnel was murdered. They thought Iran would topple and collapse and the people would take to the streets and rise up. It didn't happen. It's now clear it won't happen anytime soon. Now the United States and Israel, wounded from the conflict, are looking to extricate themselves for their own benefit. Israel's getting hit with missiles. The radar and early warning systems are offline. Their Dimona nuclear complex was hit this weekend. So they're reeling. The Gulf is reeling. They're being hit by now hypersonics and more precise projectiles, drones that they don't seem to be able to shoot down all of the drones in the swarm. The United States is running out of interceptors. It's running out of these very expensive, very finite interceptors that they need to carry on this protracted conflict. And then there's the oil problem. So the United States, realizing it won't achieve its objectives, is trying to retreat tactically with honor so that we can regroup. We can move more assets into the region. We can move our people out of harm's way. We can replenish our stockpile. That's why they're asking for $200 billion in budget reconciliation for the Pentagon, so they can make more interceptors, make more stuff, accelerate that timeline in preparation for the next war, in preparation for the next time. And in the meantime, while we're allocating $200 billion, while we're replenishing our stockpile of munitions, while we're doing the things we need to do to get ready for the next conflict, at the same time, you can bet with certainty that we are on the ground in Iran building an anti-government coalition. And this is the work we hadn't done before. Now that the IRGC has been diminished and weakened, surely we are on the ground preparing the Kurds, preparing anti-government forces in Iran, maybe other secessionist elements, so that when we go in, let's say after the midterms, after the midterm elections, maybe a year from now, then we go in heavy again, fully replenished, ready to go, and we do it with our ground force waiting to meet us there that is going to take power from the Islamic regime. And I think that maybe is how this whole thing is going to shake out. You have to always think about the timelines. You have to think about the constraints. And the constraint facing Trump is the midterms. This oil crunch, we're not going to get back to normal, they say, at the minimum within 4 months. They say even if the war ended today, the minimum time to recover, to normalize after this price shock is in 4 months. Well, that takes us to August. And that's when all the primaries are finished, and now we're in the midterm elections. So they want to give themselves time for the economy to recover for the midterms. After that point, probably they'd be more willing to go into Iran. And the other constraint is the timeline of, again, it's the production timeline for interceptors. It's the timeline that Iran is going to rebuild their capabilities in parallel. And it matches a timeline from last year. Last year, he had Midnight Hammer and Rising Lion. That was in June. And by the end of December, Netanyahu was back pitching us on another war. By February, you had, what is the operation called now? It's like Lion Unleashed or something like that, and Epic Fury. We'll get to the midterms. We'll be on the other side of it. And then they're going to call for yet another operation. And this time it's going to be fully toppling the Iranian regime, because that is the goal at any cost for the Israelis, for the United States. And that's where we are. I think that's the current state of the conflict. That is what is being telegraphed by the government. And so we'll see how this plays out over the week. We'll see if there's any other developments in negotiations, in diplomacy. We'll see what is confirmed and denied. We'll look at how Israel seems to continue to want to attack Iranian energy. There's some unconfirmed reports of this. We're monitoring all of that. And tomorrow, I'm not going to get to it tonight because this is a whole other thing. But tomorrow, I want to talk about this and you should tune in. There seems to be an angle here with J.D. Vance. And I'm not going to spoil it, but tomorrow we're going to get into all this. The forces of evil are at work even here. And once again, I'm the only one that seems to be able to see it. We talked about it last week. David Sacks is against the war now. Joe Kent resigned from the government. Then he's interviewed by Tucker. Vance is nowhere to be seen. And now all of a sudden this weekend, you start to hear, have you seen in the papers, they say, well, Vance was quietly against the war. He's fully supportive of the president, but he was expressing his doubts silently. It's like, well, then he's not really expressing them. But you're starting to see that. Vance was always against the war. Vance thought it was a bad idea. I'll spoil it a little bit. And you know what they said this weekend? Did you hear this one? They said the Iranians want to negotiate, but they don't trust Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, because that was a negotiating team in February. And look at what that profited Iran. So who do the Iranians want? Say the reports, the rumors, anonymous sources. The Iranians, they're willing to talk. So they say, but they don't just want to talk to Kushner and Witkoff. They don't trust him anymore. Who do they want to bring in to negotiate in Pakistan or Turkey next week? Why, our fearless vice president, of course. Our fearless vice president, J.D. Vance. Oh, really? Wow. That's really interesting because, you know, Steve Witkoff has been dealing with the Iranians since January of last year. Steve Witkoff has been dealing with the Qataris and Hamas and Iran and Tom Barrack and Hezbollah and Syria. He's been dealing with all these parties. And Russia, he's the number one envoy, has all these relationships, has a personal relationship with Arachi, the foreign minister of Iran. He's been there from the beginning. This is his file. All of a sudden, they say, oh, well, the Iranians, they want to talk, but they won't talk to just anybody. Not these bubble-blowing, goofy goober babies, Steve Witkoff. Now they want to bring in J.D. Vance. So are you telling me that next week J.D. Vance is going to broker the ceasefire to end the war? Because that would be something. That would be the mother of all psyops. In comes our fearless vice president, J.D. Vance, to end World War III. They wouldn't talk to Witkoff. They wouldn't talk to Kushner. They would only talk to Vance. And so maybe that's going to be the photo op, is J.D. Vance in Turkey, in Pakistan, with the speaker of Iran's parliament, shaking hands, making the deal. And then he's going to be everywhere. I ended the war. And this is how he's going to outflank little Marco. Because, see, they don't want to talk to little Marco. The top 25 Wall Street donors, they want Marco to be the nominee in 2028. The donors want to start donating to Rubio for 28. They've chosen him over Vance. The Iranians don't want little Marco. They want Vance. Ah, interesting. And you know who else hailed the diplomacy efforts today on Twitter? Take a wild guess. So obviously the diplomacy is bullshit. Bullshit. The Iranians are saying they want reparations. They're saying they want the United States to abandon our bases in the Middle East. And Trump is saying, well, they've agreed to give up nuclear enrichment. Who's hailing these bullshit negotiations as legit and commending Trump for them? Why, Joe Kent, of course. Joe Kent. Amazing. So wait a second. So wait just a minute. On Tuesday, Joe Kent said, I cannot, in good conscience, send young men and women to die in Iran like Israel made us do in Iraq, so I have to resign. That was on Tuesday. On Thursday, you're telling me these negotiations came together, and now on Monday, Joe Kent says, thank you, Mr. President. We must always pursue peace. I believe in diplomacy. So what happened in the past week then? On Tuesday, it was a fever pitch. It was a crisis. You had to step down because this is a quagmire and there's no way out and we're all going to die. On Monday, now you're hailing these efforts and who's going to lead them? Your buddy J.D. Vance? And we're all going to buy that and people will. And people will. Spoiler alert. People will. The cattle, the goyim, are going to eat it up. Now, this is a conspiracy theory. This is a conspiracy theory. All of these forces are at work right now. Israel's at work. Vance and his team are at work. Forces are at work. And it remains to be seen who will win out here. I think that is something they're trying to do, though. Whether they succeed or not, I guess time will tell. But they're definitely trying to do that. And I think that's going to be the goal. How do we turn a negative to a positive for Vance? How do we prevent this from being the liability that torpedoes his presidential ambitions? Well, we'll make him the negotiator. We'll make him the peacemaker. The peace president. And all of you Israel critical goyim are going to eat it up. You're going to say, Joe Kent is based. Tucker is based. J.D. Vance, their best friend, ended the war. You're going to fall for it. Like you did with Trump. And that's why you see that piece in the Times that says, well, Vance said he didn't like the war. He supports the president, but he didn't like the war. Something is going on. Something is going on in the White House. Mark my words. Something is going on in the White House. It is a proxy war in our own government between organized Jewry behind Rubio and the J.D. Vance team, the J.D. Vance entity, the entity known as J.D. Vance, you know, SRP 44, 49, you know, whatever, 48, SRP, what, SCP, SCP 48, the entity known as J.D. Vance, and that whole Borg-like entity, they're trying to salvage his candidacy, save him from organized Jewry behind Rubio, and they're going to try to save the day in Iran. And all ultimately, here's the next shoe to drop. The next shoe to drop is that Netanyahu is going to be facing an election in Israel. And so maybe they want Netanyahu to lose the election and to be out of the picture. So we don't restart Iran, and Vance saves the day and finds peace and everything, and maybe that's the goal. Anyway, but we'll cover that more extensively, I think, tomorrow, if nothing else happens.